Sip, savor, and experience 408 sakes and 16 restaurants at the Joy of Sake on September 16th. Go to joyofsake.com for an evening of sake perfection.
I'm Erica Weitz, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and a director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Henry Seidel, who is the founder and the CEO of Joto Sake, a leading sake import and distribution company, which he founded 11 years ago. Today, we'll talk about how Henry built his successful sake business, artisanal sake breweries that he works with, and his own sake label, and much more. Hello, Henry. Welcome to Japan.
Thank you. Thanks, Akiko.
So first of all, how did you become interested in Japan? Because I heard you minored in Japanese at college in Minnesota.
Yes, yeah. I got interested in Japan through Japanese movies, actually. I grew up in New York, and when I was in high school, there were lots of secondhand movie theaters, and you could go and watch a double feature for $5. I used to see all sorts of movies, and Kurosawa immediately captured me, and then Ozu.
Right.
And when I went to college, I decided to start studying Japanese.
Right. So the Kurosawa of the old time and the Ozu is kind of like a warm yesterday,
yeah.
Type, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And people in film sort of debate which of those two directors captures the Japanese soul. And I think that's a really interesting question. On the one hand, Ozu captures, you know, the intimacy and Japanese modern life,
right.
Family portraits, personal portraits. Mm-hmm. But then Kurosawa, you know, the sort of majesty, nobility, the fight, the samurai way. So very interesting. I think both of them are equally Japanese. But in terms of how they express Japanese culture, I think both are just amazing.
And whatever they made is still classic. It still applies
definitely.
To this whole life now.
Definitely. Yeah. Right. I mean, I saw a Tokyo Story maybe a year ago, and it just brought me to tears yet again.
Okay. And I heard that you enrolled in the homestay program in Japan, and where you're at college.
Yep.
So how did it happen, and how did you find experience?
Yeah, so I started studying Japanese in the fall of my freshman year, and then most colleges will have a year-long exchange program, but I really wanted to get to Japan much faster than waiting for junior year, and so I found an intensive language and homestay program at ICU, International Christian University in Tokyo, in Mitaka.
Right.
And so I went there for the summer between my freshman and sophomore years.
Wow.
Yeah. So after a year of Japanese, I headed off to Japan. I got my Japan Rail Pass, like I still do now, and spent about a month traveling around, staying at Ryokan, and then got to Tokyo for my homestay program. So I live with a Japanese family for about 2.5 months.
Oh, wow.
And actually just saw them about 5 months ago.
Really? Oh, still in touch?
Still in touch. Fortunately, they're both still alive. They're just amazing. Mm. Really took me in and, you know, became like a second family.
Wow. It sounds like you really started the Japanese experience from the very best.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's getting spoiled.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
And then the homestay, I'm sure that they're really ready to accept somebody who's not, you know, who's from the States. And are they, what did you find in them?
Yeah, I got really lucky. They had a very unique story. The father worked for Sumitomo and had been transferred to New York in maybe the 60s.
Mm.
And they gave birth to their second son while they were here in Queens.
Mm.
And then they moved back to Japan. And they had some connection with an American family who they felt incredibly indebted to. It's a personal story, but they always wanted to kind of repay that kindness that they had been given here.
Right.
And they also wanted to expose their son to, you know, American, you know, because he was actually born here, the younger son. So, they were eager to have a homestay student, and we got along great, and it was really wonderful.
Mm, sounds like I became their son,
your second
family.
Without being too presumptuous, you know, definitely became part of the extended family.
Mm,
yeah,
right. And then, but when you came back to the U.S., and then eventually you didn't work with a Japanese company or anything, but you said you worked for, you know, interesting companies and worked on very interesting projects. So maybe you can tell us about that experience.
Yeah. So when I came back to college, I just kept studying Japanese. I majored in philosophy. But then when I graduated college, I went to work in the restaurant business. Mm. I had been living in New York. I split my vacations between working at Kinokuniya bookstore during the summers and then working for a catering company during the winters, because that was when they were busiest.
Mm.
So when I graduated college, at that time, the JET program, which is the Japanese English program for American teachers, didn't accept people who spoke Japanese.
Oh.
They only wanted Americans who only spoke English. So I couldn't do that. So I ended up going into the food business, first working as a cook. And then in 1993, through a family friend, I was introduced to the owner of Ciaobella Gelato, which at that time was on Mott Street. Very small, primarily wholesale producer of really fantastic gelato and sorbet in Little Italy. So I started at Ciaobella in 93. I was doing everything. There were four of us.
I was only four?
Yeah.
For the company?
Yeah. 1,500 square foot facility, 2 5-gallon ice cream machines. We were chopping fruit, prepping, doing deliveries, filing invoices. You know, the company was tiny at that time.
Right.
And it was, you know, on Mott Street when it was still Little Italy and not Nolita. And the company just grew. So eventually, after doing kind of office work, I started answering the phone and taking orders from the chefs that would call us, because we didn't actually make many pints. It was mainly to restaurants.
Okay.
And so the chefs would call in their orders, and I would say, well, have you tried this other sorbet? You're only ordering this. Why don't you try this or that, or this would go with your cuisine, or this is new fruit that's in season. Why don't you try this sorbet? And the owners were like, wow, listen to you. You should go do sales. So I started doing sales, and company grew. A new owner came in, and we grew sales dramatically. And then they sent me to California to open the West Coast branch of Ciaobella.
Right. Well, I just number. You have $300,000 to $1.5 million when you're there in 2 years.
Yeah, which, you know, is not all me. One of the other owners was a very strong business person and salesperson, but it was really the two of us doing sales. And, you know, it showed me at least how if you have a great product and you're passionate about it and you're making it well, that a business can grow. Mm-hmm. And that was just really exciting to be a part of.
Right. And then you moved to Brooklyn Brewery and ended up being the sales manager. It was in 1998.
Yes. So I joined Brooklyn in 98. At that time, the company was both a beer distributor and the Brooklyn brand. There was a division called the Craft Brewers Guild, mm-hmm. and I was the sales manager for the west side of Manhattan, selling just an amazing portfolio of craft beer from all over the world, Belgian, German, British beers, and did that, and then was asked to join the brewery division as operations manager and then general manager of the brewery division. So I had the honor of working for Steve Hindy, who is one of the two founders, and Garrett Oliver, the brewmaster. And it was great. It was Brooklyn is an incredible company and a great brand.
And I love the culture.
And the beer business is amazing. Mm. I mean, there's just something really wonderful about beer and about beer companies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it spans all spectrums of people and ranges within a company. It's great.
Right. And it's like I got a chance to speak to Garrett Oliver a couple of times, and his mind is still like entrepreneurial, like really young brewery.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's amazing. It's like the world. It's really, the production is really one of the biggest in the world, right?
Yeah. So. Brooklyn is definitely now one of the biggest craft beer makers, and he has not stopped innovating and pushing, and he's a really dynamic, great guy. We have dinner every once in a while. He loves Japanese food. He's got so much energy and passion and integrity.
Right. Yeah. So maybe it's something in common with a small Japanese brewery, sake breweries.
Yeah. I mean, the sake breweries obviously have more family history. Mm-hmm. You know, Brooklyn is a first-generation company, and American, you know, younger, sort of developing. But you have the same small, I mean, now it's much bigger, but you have the same heart of being a small producer and wanting to make a truly excellent product, and to make a product that's as good when you're tiny as when you're big.
Right.
So that's, I think, what all producers are aiming for, even if, as they get big.
Mm. Right. Okay. And then, in 2002, you were recruited by Moët Hennessy Louis Vuitton. And that's another interesting thing. So what happened?
Yeah, when I was at Brooklyn, I did the executive MBA program at NYU. And I started looking around for other opportunities. I had worked for, you know, these smaller, scrappy startups. Mm. And I felt like, okay, I've got my MBA. And I want to try a bigger company and see what it's like.
That's really big.
Yeah, it's very big. I did actually, interestingly enough, try to use my MBA to then work for a Japanese company because I still wanted to connect with Japan and use my Japanese. But at that point, my Japanese, as is now, was not, you know, native level, business level, you know, and that's what you need when you're looking for a job.
Right.
So I ended up getting hired by Moët Hennessy. They had just bought Belvedere Vodka, and they hired me to be the director of international marketing to launch Belvedere around the world through the Moët Hennessy network.
Wow. Hmm.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you love growing business or brand from small to big, and actually that's what you're doing right
now.
Yeah.
Too. I'm not sure what I would do at a bigger company where I'm supposed to steer the ship, but I certainly am happy to get it from A to G or H.
Right. Yeah. So it sounds like you had the right path to be your own business owner, right?
Yeah.
And then, but now your life is devoted to Japanese sake, so how did you get into sake in the first place?
Yeah, so when I was working at Brooklyn Brewery, my wife, who we were just dating at the time, you know, said, well, wow, if you're into Japan and you love alcohol, obviously, we should go to this sake bar, this sake restaurant in Midtown. And so she took me to Sakagura.
Well, Sakagura is, I think, it's one of the most iconic legendary sake bars in Yoko, right?
Absolutely. And they're just celebrating their, I think, 30th anniversary this year.
That opened in 1996, basically.
That's, so maybe,
Oh, actually, 96? Well, 86.
Yeah, right. I forget which anniversary, but they're coming up on a big one.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, Sakagura is incredible. I mean, even by Japanese standards, Sakagura is amazing.
Right.
You know, they have and had, which is what blew me away and opened my eyes, just, you know, a menu which is incredibly well organized, really informative, explains different types and how the sakes taste, and they have specials and new sakes. And anyway, I had never really had sake. When I was an exchange student, I was diligently practicing kanji and watching Japanese baseball, maybe drinking a little beer, and it just wasn't part of my world. But then I was exposed to it, and I was like, my God, this is like beer or wine. This is, you know, there's so much diversity and complexity and different places and types of rice and styles of product. And I just started going there. And actually the manager, Kadoi-san, who's now at Bohemia, you know, became a good friend. And then I started buying sake at retail, Aster Wine and Spirits, which at that time was on Aster, was really like had the best selection. And I started buying books. I started buying magazines, going to events, every tasting event I could go to. Just really dove into it. Danchu, that was my go-to magazine. I would go to Kinokuniya and buy Danchu. Right.
Danchu is like gourmet magazine.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And it's like it's the abbreviation of the men's kitchen.
Is that right?
Yeah,
right, because it's Danchu.
So like for men's cooking at home and then drink sake, that kind of.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Well, they're pretty much the best magazine. I mean, they're others, but coming out of Japan and reviewing sake. So, yeah, I started getting really into it, and then I started thinking about starting a sake import company.
Wow. So it's kind of like the floodgate opened about sake, like your whole passion just exploded in a way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So in 2005, you founded Joto Sake, an importer and distributor of Japanese sake. So why? Because you could have stayed just the hobbyist of sake.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had had these experiences of being in companies that grew. I had been a part of it and felt that I had learned the basic skills to do that. And then also there was just various timing. The owner of Belvedere had a payout for the employees as Moët Hennessy bought more of the company. So financially, I was in a position I could do that. But I also, so those were two key points. But then also I felt like there was something else that could be done in sake than what was being done, which, of course, everyone thinks they can do something better than other people, right?
Right. But I think 2005 was a good timing, right?
Yeah. Definitely.
I think the market was growing steadily. I think since the late 90s, along with the popularity of Japanese food and restaurants, so everybody was just waiting, sake. But then not much was done, like in terms of education and sales.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, it was definitely a very ripe time. I think people were really getting interested in sake, but it wasn't fully developed. There were other sake bars. I mean, obviously, the people in Sakagura owned Decibel. But there was just more and more interest. There were more articles being written about sake. Some non-Japanese restaurants using sake in their wine programs.
Right.
So it was definitely a good time to do it.
Right. Even, I think, Western restaurants started to carry sake slowly that time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, and the name Jōtō means highest quality.
Yeah.
And so what is the vision of philosophy of Jōtō sake?
Right. Well, I wanted, in terms of the name, something people could say, and obviously something with meaning. But what I really wanted to do with the company, I felt that when I looked around in the wine world, if I bought a bottle of wine and I turned around and looked at the label, if I saw it was imported by a certain wine importer, Cobrand, Michael Skernick, Frederick Wildman, Kermit Lynch, that, you know, it would be of a high quality, that I felt that I had that trust as a consumer, even if I didn't know anything about what the wine label meant. And I felt that with sake, there were amazing sakes coming in, and obviously amazing companies. But that when it came to the selection of the sakes, that it wasn't entirely consistent. And also, when I dig deeper and tried to find information about the sake and the packaging, that it just wasn't well done. It wasn't easy for me to find and figure out. And here I was, someone who had studied Japanese.
Right.
So it was, I felt, wow, well, if I'm having this sort of time, then the average consumer is definitely not. So I wanted to have a selection of sakes that was consistently good, that was of the highest quality, that were really excellent, and that were all different, so that, you know, there wasn't, we weren't duplicating, which we don't, by region. So we all of our brewers are from different regions. And then they're also very different stylistically. So we might have some that are really rich and earthy and funky, and then some that are really delicate and pretty and fruity and delightful. You know, and really try to have a difference. You know, in Japanese you say sorizore, like sorizore no tokucho ga arimasu, like that they each have their specialty and their regionality and their personality. And then obviously the people, you know, was another major factor, and just who they were as I met them over the years. And
Right. Well, they have a big strength because you can really communicate deeply with those people in Japanese.
Yeah, I mean, my Japanese has completely gone downhill, but I have the appreciation and understanding and desire, and I can converse a lot. But yes, they really saw that I had a sincere passion, and that had a big impact.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And, well, I have to say that we will talk about the breweries later, but, you know, like there's a sake tasting event and it's by Jōtō Sake. Oh, I have to go because I know there's always good sake there.
Oh,
so.
Thank you. Thank you.
Right. So, yeah, but so now you know the market. So who's buying Japanese sake in the U.S. now?
I mean, it's, you know, definitely mainly Americans. I mean, obviously there are Japanese expats buying sake at Japanese food stores, and that's a, you know, very good business, and those stores are unbelievable. But you know, really, it's now younger consumers. I think sake has gone through a transformation, and people have talked about this on your show, but, you know, 20 years ago or more, but really 20 years ago, but still for some people, sake is thought of as very generic. They have no concept that there are different types. They've had it hot in a carafe and in little cups, and that's all they really know. And, and that's how sake was 20 years ago.
Right.
And now with, you know, people before me and people come on since me and us and restaurants and consumers and stores and sake experts and so forth, the whole market has moved to show people what an enormous range there is of sake.
Right.
And I think that that has drawn in, you know, a lot of young consumers. And now people who are, I mean, people who are, you know, 32 years old, you know, started drinking when they were 21, which is when I started my company. So, you know, people in their 30s and 40s, they've grown up with sake knowing something totally different than people who are 1560 nice. or 1670. You know, so it just what people think of sake is totally different now.
Right.
And they may not know anything.
But I think that's, the millennials generation. They saw, when they're born, their parents are eating sushi. And the supermarkets and everywhere.
Yeah.
So it's not the foreign thing. It's a part of their American food life in a way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it kind of happens with everything. I mean, I don't know. I guess people still buy Hershey chocolate bars. But, most people don't even look at that anymore.
Right. So you need gender, age group, any lifestyle, the diversity is the key.
I mean, I think that obviously the more cutting edge communities, Brooklyn, Northwest, hipper parts of California, it's, definitely edgier. Those are called the thought leaders.
Mm.
But I see sake. I go all over the country selling sake. And I mean, it's even improving in, Tampa, Florida, or, San Antonio, Texas, or places that are, call it more mainstream and not as supposedly sophisticated, are now, having much better selections.
Right.
And it's just not treated as like house sake anymore.
Mm. Right. It sounds like, the main many restaurants, sommeliers started to kind of initiating putting sake on their wine list.
Yeah. And that's still so important. I mean, the increased sophistication and people who really are experts, that is so important for that part of the community to be strong. And there's a wine certification program called WSET that now has a level 3 sake education component.
Mm.
So it's really getting taken seriously and cultivating those people who are experts.
Mm.
But I think at the same time, the average consumer is more inclined to drink sake, knows a bit more, and the market is, I hope, getting friendlier to that person too.
Right. And then there is annual the alcohol beverage competition in London that's called...
IWC.
Right. So that's the sake category, which is very strong now.
Yes. That's a major component of that competition. There's another wine and spirits competition in London. Actually, the Houston Rodeo and Livestock Wine Festival has sake as a part of it. And
really?
That sounds like a very... funny, wine festival, but it actually in Texas is a big deal. So,
awesome.
It's great. It's great.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah, actually, I tasted the Texas wine. And some of them are really good too. So that's like open mindedness.
Yeah.
What a great surprise.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Okay. So let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about Hermit's own super tasty sake. So please stay with us.
The Joy of Sake invites you to the largest and liveliest sake tasting event in New York. With over 400 premium sakes to taste, including gold and silver award winners from the U.S. National Sake Appraisal and 16 of New York's top restaurants providing sake-licious appetizers. The event takes place on Friday, September 16th from 6:30 to 9:30 at the Metropolitan Pavilion on 18th Street. You'll be able to sip, savor, and experience a record 408 premium sakes, all in peak condition, with over half of them unavailable in the U.S. and exclusively for the Joy of Sake. All categories of sake will be represented, with over half from the elite Daiginjo sakes. Plus, nibble on sake-inspired appetizers, all carefully curated and perfectly paired with two creative poke stations by Narita and Sakamai, plus elegantly crafted appetizers from Sushi Nakazawa, Sakagura, Zuma, and more. Celebrate the world's finest sakes in an evening of sake perfection at the Joy of Sake. For more information, go to joyofsake.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Henry Seidel, who is the founder and CEO of Joto Sake, a leading sake import and distribution company, which he founded 11 years ago. So How do you select sake to import? What are your criteria?
Well, a few things. One, it has to be delicious and really high quality. So we do a lot of research on breweries and really try to find the best. You know, now that we have a decent-sized portfolio, it's really about choosing the next sakes. So we're looking for new regions. We're looking for styles we don't have, flavor profiles. Not so much price points because, you know, there's a range that we get from all of our producers. But we're looking for now new regions that we don't represent.
Okay.
But almost always family-owned and operated. Our oldest brewery is 15th generation, founded in the 1540s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The youngest is third generation.
You know, this one is the oldest one. We have eight breweries we're working with.
Eight breweries that we import from Shichi Honyari.
Okay.
The Seven Spearsmen, which is made at the Tomita Brewery, is our oldest.
And it's Tomita, in Shiga Prefecture in near Kyoto, right?
Yep.
Right.
And then we have about three breweries that are sixth or seventh generation, another that's 13th generation, founded in 1778.
Wow.
I think when I last did the math, between the eight companies, there were 64 generations and 1,520 years of family sake making history.
Yes, you cannot even think of how far is
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I know.
Right. So, well, the, you know, like, there's so many different, like, your diversity, like you said,
yeah,
right? So, how do you describe the difference between, you know, this brewery, that region? What determines the differences?
Yeah, well, the differences in regions really relate a lot to the climate, the type of cuisine.
Interesting.
And a little bit the style of sake of that region. You know, sake is brewed, so there's a lot of human element to it. So it's not entirely, it's not really driven by terroir, purely agriculture the way wine is. There's many ingredients, and it's really about how they make them. But the colder regions generally produce fruitier and lighter style sake because the yeast that produces more aromatic style sake in Ginjo and Daiginjo is easiest to make under cold fermentation methods, and those regions tend to produce those styles. At the same time, those regions produce some very earthy and rustic style sake because they're cold,
right,
and so they drink warm sake during the winter. The more southern regions into like the Kobe area produce a kind of drier, grainier, more, I'd say, masculine, traditional style sake. And those are, you know, the Nada district of Kobe is where a lot of the original sake breweries popped up.
Right.
So they're kind of sticking to tradition a little bit. But then, you know, when you go farther south, you get, again, like a bit more grainy, ricier, more umami style sake. And, of course, there are trends in sake towards, let's say, drier, earthier, richer, or fruitier, more aromatic. And that kind of changes. And I see that in the U.S., that people's tastes also change. But generally, you know, we are looking for breweries that have a sense of who they are and what they want to make, generally have a house style, but that can still have a really big range. And that's amazing to see, is when you can still identify, that's what we look for, is you can still identify a sake as being that brand, let's say Shichi Honyari, but is very different across, you know, a range of the sakes they make.
Right, interesting. And we had Eric Schrei, who directed the film The Birth of Sake, in episode 47, and discussed how traditional sake brewers are struggling to survive. So how do you see that your brewers are struggling and trying to see, you know, like catching the trend?
Our breweries are doing great. I mean, the Jizake movement, the handcrafted sake business is very good in Japan.
Right. So Jizake, ji means local.
Yeah.
So it's more like deeper, artisanal.
Yes, the artisanal craft sakes are doing great. Now, that doesn't mean they're all doing great. There are obviously some that are not. Mm. And, you know, I think one of their biggest challenges now is finding people.
Mm.
Because there's been a population flux towards the big cities, and
right.
most of these breweries are in the country.
Right. Just like describing the birth of sake, it's not easy work. It's
yeah, it's hard work, cold winters, hands going in a lot of cold water all the time.
Mm.
It's, you know, bending over, picking things up. It's it's not easy work.
Mm.
But the products themselves, the sake breweries, you know, that type of sake is very popular.
Right.
Very popular.
So the future is good.
I think so. I think the future of sake is great. There's also been some changes in the laws, the taxation on imported rice in Japan, so lower tariffs. So now a lot of the farmers that were growing cooking rice are starting to grow sake rice because they get more money for it.
Mm.
So the supply of sake rice, is increasing, which is great because, you know, one of our biggest challenges as an importer has been to, you know, meet the demand and not go out of stock. And I think looking forward, that's going to be better and better.
Right.
It's going to be more availability of product.
Oh, wow, that's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Okay. And now you also have your own sake brand.
Yeah.
So why did you decide to make your own sake?
Well, you know, for 7 years, we did not have our own brand. I didn't want to do that. And, you know, still the core of our business is our imported traditional portfolio. But what I found was I was going around the country selling sake, and every sake sales call is a Sake 101 lesson. You know, I'd go to portfolio tastings with wine companies, with our distributors, and be in a big ballroom with lots of wine importers. And people would come around with their glasses, and they'd put in front of the wine company, and the guy would pour the glass and say, well, this is the 05, or this is the Cab, this is the Merlot, this is the, and, you know, the drinker, the buyer would taste it and know what they're doing. Then they get to my table and they go, okay, I got to rinse up my glass. Now tell me about sake. And you'd have to go through this whole thing.
Right.
Junmai, Hinjo, Daiginjo, this, that, and all these questions. And it just, you know, became maddening. And so I started feeling there's got to be an easier way to do this. I mean, sure, we have a website. We try to do seminars and classes and stuff. But there's got to be a way to get people to know the basics of sake much more easily. And so that started to really vex me. And then also I would meet people and they'd say, oh, you import sake. That's amazing. I had this sake. It came in a brown bottle and it had a white label with Japanese characters on it. And I'd be like, well, that could be about 1,000 different sakes. And then every once in a while someone would say, well, it actually came in this thin blue bottle. And I'd be like, oh, I know what that is. That's Meibo, or, you know, or it had this, or they said it was made with this. So anyway, I started thinking, well, what can we do to educate people and teach them about sake much more basically, and also give them something they can remember so they can, you know what to buy again. So I then really started thinking about doing our own brand, making our own brand. Lots of people wanted me to do the, you know, stupid idea of, you know, samurai sake or, you know, ninja this or that. And I was like, God, give me a break. But so what I wanted to do was to create a sake lesson on the bottle and teach people about sake and also give them the really basic information they need about that product. Like people want to know, what does it taste like? You know, what do I pair it with? How do I serve it? Those basic things. So I looked around for a great packaging designer and ultimately found one in Adelaide, Australia.
Okay. That's another nice twist.
Yeah. A company called Parallax that had done all of this wonderful wine packaging. And a lot of wine labels that involve typography and imagery and very visual.
Mm.
And I was like, these guys are doing exactly what I want to do. And I decided to use our name, Johto, for our brand, as opposed to Ninja or something silly like that. And just to have it be our selection of classic types. So there's Junmai, Junmai Ginjo, Dai Ginjo, Nigori. And for each sake label to teach people something about sake.
Hmm.
So the Junmai has a circle and explains shinpaku, which is the starch in the center of the grain. And the Nigori has a filter, kind of an abstract image of a filter. The Ginjo has little bubbles of pink and red that are the two kinds of yeast that are blended to make that sake.
Right.
So they're all kind of educational. I wanted them to be kind of sake geeky, and they are, but they're also very plain spoken explanations.
Mm. Right. So that's what you need, and you don't have to do that one-on-one everywhere.
Exactly. Hopefully it'll cut down on that part.
Yeah. So, you know, I know that you work with your breweries that you work with for your import and distribution.
Yeah. So all the Johto brand is made by our producers. So it's wonderful, excellent jizake. We didn't go farm it off to a big mass producer. So it's really their sake. We say who makes it on the label. You know, and it's not super cheap. It's very well-priced, but it's not like, you know, aiming to be a super affordable sake. It's still a high-quality jizake, but just more understandable.
Well, the you know, the fact that you work with the breweries for sake making, you're making the, you know, relationship even more stronger.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely, it's selling more sake for them, and hopefully it's kind of taking care of that, like, 101 that we're always trying to do as just a foundation of sake. Because when that was another thing is, you know, I want to talk about Eiko Fuji, Watari Bune, and the story of Watari Bune rice, or Seikyo, and talk about the water in Hiroshima. And you know, when I'm talking about their brands, I want to be telling their stories and what's interesting about their sake and how it tastes. I don't want to be giving someone what is Cabernet or what is Merlot. Like, you should know that by now. Or you go ask somebody else that. You know, so it enables us to kind of do the different things that we want to do, you know, which we have to do.
Well, I think raising the bar to the next level for everybody.
Yeah.
Right? Because I think the market is totally ready.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, mentioned Astor Wines and Spirits, they have over 200 different kinds of sake, for instance.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't think of that 20 years ago, and it's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? And there are people trying different things in terms of branding with sake, and I think that's actually very exciting. You know, some people might look down their noses on it. They're purists and they're sake snobs, and they're like, oh, that's, you know, this or that. But actually, I mean, if you look at the wine industry, wine years ago became much more accessible. Robert Mondavi was really the one who, you know, was the trailblazer to make California wine both very high quality but also accessible. Whereas, let's say, French, Italian, and Spanish wines are still kind of often stuck in a particular mold when it comes to packaging. But actually, over the past, you know, 10 or 15 years, wines have totally broken their own mold and gotten much more fun and playful and colorful and visual and much more experimental in terms of branding. And I think that the fact that sake is doing that, that companies other than ours are breaking out and trying new things. And you see that with Japanese sake makers, too. I mean, you go to Japan and some of the labels now, you know, in stores are very fun and creative. And I think that shows that the category has confidence, that we're ready to be fun and playful. And we don't just have to do, you know, the traditional thing. Like, you know, there can be more freedom. I think that's great.
Right. And also, I think a sake market kind of expanded towards American. And then it's more sort of triggered by this cultural difference.
Yeah.
And the freedom.
Yeah. And, you know, it's also really, I mean, I'm sure you experience this a lot when you're in Japan. You meet someone who's like 13th generation, you know, knife maker, and then they tell you that they love like Twizzlers or something, you know, like, like, you know, I mean, Japanese people can be incredibly quirky and fun and it, you know, it doesn't all have to be so serious. And I think there's so much fun in Japanese culture, too.
Right.
And They want to bring that, too.
Exactly. It's like a Kurosawa and an anime. It's coexisting in the same country, right? So that's the thing.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So where can we find your Joto sake?
If you're looking for it at retail, Sakaya is a great store.
In East Village.
In the East Village. Mm-hmm. Brooklyn Wine Exchange, Smith & Vine. There's other stores. I'm forgetting the names. And sorry to those customers, you know, in terms of restaurants, obviously Sakagura, Decibel, Sushi Seki, you know, many restaurants in Brooklyn, Okonomi, you know, lots of...
Wow.
Yeah.
You have to find
those
places.
Yeah.
I want to try.
Yeah.
So, okay. So what's your plan for the future?
To keep doing what we're doing. I mean, I think we have a lot of room for growth, just hiring more people and doing what we do better. So I'm always looking for ways to do that, to
right.
be more efficient and to grow the category.
That's your mindset.
What's that?
Right. That's your mindset.
It is.
Growing.
It is. It is.
Right. Okay, great. Thank you for joining us today, Henry.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, listeners, if you'd like to know more about Henry's work, please go to jotosake.com. That is JOTOSAKE, jotosake.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes and Stitcher podcasts. And please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. And our engineer today is David Tatasciore. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.